Hello and thank you for joining us. You're listening to Words of Welcome, the teaching ministry of Welcome Baptist Church, Heathfield.
Good morning. I wonder if you have ever had busy days. It's something we all face, isn't it? When's the last time you got home at the end of the day, maybe you got into bed and you thought, God, that was a busy day. In our house, we like to get a bit competitive, and I bet it's the same with you. If you recorded our dinner time conversations, a lot of them would start with a contest of who exactly had the busiest day or had the least amount of sleep. We view it as a badge of honour. Well, Good Friday was a very busy day for Jesus. It began at midnight in the Garden of Gethsemane, and it ended at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. In those 15 hours, Jesus underwent 12 main ordeals. Firstly, Jesus prayed in Gethsemane, where he prayed for the cup of suffering that he knew was coming to be removed from him and where he sweated blood. Secondly, Jesus was betrayed, he was arrested, and the disciples deserted him. Thirdly, Jesus was questioned and put on trial before the priests and the council. Fourthly, Peter denied Jesus 3 times. Fifthly, the Sanhedrin condemned Jesus. Sixthly, Judas killed himself. Seventhly, Jesus appeared before Pilate for the first time. Eighthly, Jesus appeared before Herod for the only time. Ninthly, Jesus appeared before Pilate for the second time. Tenthly, Jesus was flogged and mocked by the Roman soldiers. And 11thly, he was crucified. And finally, 12thly, he died and was buried. Now, rather than go through each one of these 12 things and leave us all here till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I thought I would go through only 3 of them. And I want to look at 3 particular scenes that highlight the justice or the lack of justice that Jesus suffered on this day. Justice is something that we all want, isn't it? We all look to the world and we all cry out for more justice. I remember when I was 8 or 9 and Mackenzie 6 or 7, we misbehaved a lot. We always did wrong to each other, as you can imagine. And our parents thought of a new way of trying to discipline us. If one of us had done something wrong to the other one could either offer them justice or give them mercy. With the catch that whichever one we gave them, we would receive the next time we did something wrong to them. Did we want to see them punished, but be punished later on? Or did we want to give them mercy and so receive mercy later on? I think it's a good idea. It didn't work. We always were more than happy to see the other one get in trouble, even if it meant getting in trouble a bit later on. Now, you might ask, why was Ben not included in this? Obviously, because he's never done anything wrong at all.
That's true.
In the UK, we have become increasingly desensitized to injustice, I think. We see it in the world around us. Even in the last few weeks, we hear stories from Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, Afghanistan, China, and Pakistan of how innocent civilians are the ones who often bear the greatest costs of war and extremism. A number of you in here have probably watched the ITV documentary about the post office scandal. Injustice is so rife in the world around us, and it's so easy to become jaded and desensitized to it. I think it's easy as well to look past the physical ordeal that Jesus suffered on Good Friday, because we know, and we live in a post-Sunday world, we know that Sunday is coming. It's not easy to fully appreciate the pain and the injustice that Jesus went through almost 2,000 years ago for our sakes. I listened to a sermon by Ligon Duncan, who's now the Chancellor of the Reformed Theological Seminary in America. And he went to great lengths to explain the exact depth of Jesus's physical discomfort on Good Friday. I'm not going to do the same. This is a family service after all, and there are lots of kids here. But I think it's a beneficial thing for us to have in the back of our mind as we look at these passages, that Jesus would have been under an enormous amount of physical discomfort as well as the emotional discomfort. So the 3 pictures or scenes that I want to focus on today are firstly, Jesus's trials before Pilate. Secondly, the release of Barabbas. And finally, the thief on the cross. So before we start reading the Bible, I'm going to pray. Father, I pray that as I speak and as I read the Bible, that you would draw near to us, that you'd give us the ears we need to hear. You give me the words that you want me to say. Father, I pray that we would know you better, love you more after this. Amen. So the first passage looks at our first scene, which is Jesus' trials before Pilate. And Ben is going to put Luke 23, verse 1 on the screen. Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." But they were urgent, saying, "He stirs up all the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place." We're going to jump now to verse 11. What happens in the intervening bit is that when Pilate realizes Jesus is from Galilee, he transfers him to Herod because Herod has jurisdiction over Galilee. We're going to look at this a bit more in a moment. So verse 11, Ben. "And Herod, with his soldiers, treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then, arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, 'You brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him.'" In some circles, in particularly religious circles, we tend to view the concept of Roman justice with extreme negativity. We see it as being punitive, as backward, as barbaric. But this is a bit of a misrepresentation. Yes, it was ruthless. Yes, their punishments were viewed, even by Roman standards, as being obscene. But their legal system was relatively advanced, especially by the time of Jesus. I'm sorry for geeking out a little bit over this, but I was forced to study Roman law as part of my undergrad, and I'm very happy I finally got a practical use for it. Rome valued the rule of law, the idea that every person should be able to be held accountable before a court. Even consuls, which were the closest things Rome had to prime ministers, could have legal proceedings brought against them. In this passage, the reason that Pilate sends Jesus to Herod is because Pilate was governor only of the Roman province of Judea, whilst Herod was king of the rest of Judea. He was a client king of Rome and had jurisdiction over Galilee. Rome could only administer an empire of such disparate peoples by ensuring that they respected their cultures and their beliefs. There are two legal systems, one applying only in Italy between Roman citizens, and one that applied throughout the rest of the empire. The law of the nations, the second one, contained only what the Romans considered to be natural laws on which every people should agree. For example, the prohibition on murder. In short, the fact that Jesus was denied justice, even though Pilate explicitly found him not guilty of any of the charges placed before him, would have been almost as shocking to the subjects of the Roman Empire as it is to us today. The two main charges that Pilate entertained against Jesus were, firstly, that he was misleading the people of Israel, and secondly, that he had forbidden the Israelites from paying tribute to Caesar. We can easily fact check this, and we know the second one's not true because we all know the Bible verse that says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's." We know the first one is untrue because we know Jesus now better than the priests did, better than those who accused him did, and certainly better than Pontius Pilate did. Who in this room can ever say that they have ever been misled by Jesus? Even the very idea of it makes me cringe and flinch. We know that Jesus does not mislead. R.C. Sproul, in his sermon on Jesus' trial, explained that, and this is to quote him, "Jesus called his disciples to himself with a simple command, 'Follow me.' And now the authorities before Pilate were saying, 'He was misleading our people.' 'Beloved,' he says, 'leaders in office mislead people all the time. Just read the newspaper.' But not once did Jesus Christ ever mislead a single soul." He continues, "Every sin I have ever committed was a result of my not following Jesus. How many times in my life have I failed to follow Jesus? We do not follow Jesus when we sin, and we sin because we do not want to follow Jesus. The world does not want to follow Jesus. Our culture does not want to follow Jesus, and our government does not want to follow Jesus. Even though Pilate declared Jesus innocent, even though nothing guilty in him could be found, he still resolved to flog him, even before he decided to have him executed. The late Tim Keller referred to the kingdom of heaven as heralding what he termed the great reversal. We're familiar with this as a concept because Jesus explains in Matthew 20:16 that the first will be last and the last will be first. In this great reversal, we see a great subversion of what society now views and what first century Jewish society then would have viewed as being righteous, as what it would have meant to have been a good person, or of who deserves God's mercy. Jesus was not what the Jews of the time were expecting the Messiah to look like. Jesus was the person least of all in human history who deserved what he suffered before Pilate. The great reversal, as bargains go, does not look a particularly attractive one for Jesus. The Son of God suffered the injustice he did not deserve so that we, the unjust, could go free. That's our first scene or picture. Our second scene that I want to look at is the release of Barabbas. And we're going to look at Luke 23, verses 18 to 25. And these follow immediately on from the verses that we've just read. But they all cried out together, "Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder." Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus. But they kept shouting, "Crucify, crucify him." A third time he said to them, "Why? What evil has he done? I have found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him." But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. I don't know if, like me, any of you ever catch yourself finding a degree of sympathy for Pilate. In Rome, being a governor was a political position for those wanting advancement. And so Pilate would have wanted to return to Rome, showing that he had been able to keep the Judean people quiet and above all profitable so that he could rise in office. This manifests in his desire to keep the religious leaders happy because he knows that if he can keep them happy, he can keep the Jewish people happy. But this comes into tension with his desire to see justice done as any good Roman governor would. It also comes into tension with his own desire to stay as far away from the controversy as possible. We know that Pilate was not a brilliant man, even by Roman standards, R.C. Sproul says. Pilate was considered abysmal. In the end, in his desire to pacify his Jewish subjects, Pilate caves to their demands and releases Barabbas. In the other Gospels, we know that Pilate washes his hands of Jesus and thinks he is free of the guilt of what happens to him. Because of the Roman rule of law, only the Roman authorities were able to execute people in the empire lawfully. Pilate was the only man in Judea capable of lawfully executing a prisoner, but still he caved to the cries of the multitude. How often do we do the same thing? How often do we, in spite of our trust and the authority that we have in Jesus, turn from him and bow to the cries of the culture around us? It's very easy to do, and it invades every context in which we live our lives, at work, at school, at university, even in our families. By way of illustration, in an RAC survey that was completed a couple of years ago, they asked people why people primarily broke the speed limits. And the most common answer, which was chosen by 42% of respondents, was that they were only travelling at the same speed as other motorists. This pressure to conform, to bow to the cries of the world, to bow to what the world thinks, even in the face of Jesus, is a pressure that we all face. And Pilate, bowing to this pressure, releases Barabbas in place of Jesus, despite knowing that Barabbas is the guilty one, whilst Jesus is innocent. Not only is Barabbas guilty, he is guilty of the exact same crime that Jesus has been falsely accused of. Names are important things in the Bible. In the book of Hosea, God commands Hosea to name his children in highly symbolic ways. He names his first son Jezreel, which means God scatters, to show that the Jewish people will later be scattered. He names his daughter Lo-Ruhama, meaning not loved, as an indication that God will, at some stage, withhold his love from Israel. Importantly, this is not that he will stop loving them. It's just that he will withhold his love. His wife's second son, he was called to name Lo-Ami, meaning not my people, to show that the relationship that the Israelites enjoyed with God under the Mosaic law was nearing a great shift. Even the name Israel was given to Jacob to show that he and his descendants would struggle with God. Barabbas is no different. His name is formed from the prefix bar, meaning son of, and the suffix abbas, the father. In Matthew's gospel, he is even given the first name Jesus, meaning, as well we know from the Christmas story, God saves. So his full name was Jesus, God saves, Barabbas, the son of God. We are all Barabbas. We are all sons and daughters of God. And Jesus, God himself, in human form, substituted himself for us on the cross, just as he did for Barabbas physically in the jail. Jesus' punishment on Good Friday was one that he suffered for all of us. He was crucified in place of Barabbas. In Barabbas, we have to see ourselves. He was the first person redeemed. Barabbas was an insurrectionist. He was a murderer. We don't look kindly on this nowadays. We can name insurrectionist groups, freedom fighters, murderers, and we don't like them very much. But this is the kind of person that Jesus can redeem, and it's an encouragement for us. I remember Andy Diamond's sermon a few months ago where he was talking about the prodigal son. He said that it can offend him and it offends me that there are some people that God can deem worthy of forgiveness, that there are some people who can do things that I see as being so evil that they could not be reconciled to God. But thank goodness, he said, that it is up to God and not up to him. Thank goodness it is up to God and not me. Instead, we should take this as encouragement for ourselves that God can save such evil people. In 1 Timothy 1:15, Paul writes, "This saying is trustworthy and deserving of full acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the foremost." Has anyone ever felt like that? I have, a lot. Alistair Begg said in a sermon once that if he knew exactly what went on in the minds of all of his congregation, he would refuse to speak to them. But, he said, if they knew everything that went on in his mind, they should refuse to listen to him. If you knew half of what goes on in my head, there's no way you'd have even let me in the building, let alone stand up here. And if I knew half of what went on in your mind, I'd go to another church. We all sympathise with Paul. We all feel foremost among sinners. That Jesus might redeem Barabbas and suffer in his place shows the great lengths to which he will go for us. You might be sitting here thinking, I have done too much wrong that God can ever forgive me. But that is not true. He can forgive. He does forgive. The great reversal meant for Barabbas that he was not crucified as the lawful punishment for his actual crimes, but that Jesus instead was executed in his place. Both of them were at the receiving ends of an injustice that day, but Barabbas's was so much more pleasant, and how much more pleasant is ours as a result. So that was our second picture, Barabbas being released. And now the third and final picture, the thief on the cross. And for this, we're going to jump a number of verses to Luke 23, verse 39. And in the intervening time, Jesus is crucified. He has to take his cross to Golgotha. Simon of Cyrene steps in to carry it for him. And he is crucified along with two others. So verse 39. One of the criminals who are hanged railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." And he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus said to him, "Truly, I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise." Do you want to know what really strikes me about this passage? It's that both of them knew that Jesus was who he claimed to be. The one who railed against Jesus knew it. He cried at Jesus asking for him to save him. The other knew that Jesus would soon come into his kingdom, but only one of them joined him in heaven. There is a great passage in the New Testament that Jesus' enemies didn't simply disbelieve him. Many of them understood. Instead, as this criminal here, they wanted something that was different and contrary to who Jesus was. The criminal on the cross wanted only the physical salvation, and he wanted to avoid the death of crucifixion. He did not want Jesus. He wanted only what Jesus could do for him. In Matthew's gospel, after Jesus is crucified and died, the Pharisees go to Pilate and they demand that he post a guard outside the tomb because they understood Jesus' teaching that he would be resurrected on the third day. And they wanted to avoid the disciples coming to the tomb, making off with the body and pretending that Jesus had risen from the dead. We know, after reading the New Testament, that these fears are baseless. We are told consistently that the disciples did not understand Jesus' teaching about the resurrection. How on earth did the Pharisees, who had been trying to trip Jesus up, how did they understand when the disciples, who had been with Jesus every day for 3 years, when they didn't understand, how did they not understand, but the Pharisees did? But it's not this belief that is enough. James says it's not enough. In James 2:19, he says, "You must believe that God is one. You do well. Even the demons believe, and they shudder." We must submit to Jesus. It's not enough to simply believe. The Pharisees understood who Jesus claimed to be. The criminal understood and the demons understand. But they are not saved. They were not saved. They did not love, follow, or submit to Jesus as Son of God. And that's the difference between the thief that was saved and the criminal who was not. The thief that was saved said, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." Thank you, Ben. There is so much in just these few words. Remember me. He knew Jesus was going to rise again. He knew Jesus was not going to die. He knew this was not the end. He knew as well that Jesus was going to be king of his kingdom. He knew of Jesus' power. In those few words, he submits to Jesus. He puts his faith and his trust in him. We too must submit to Jesus as the Son of God who died in our place. What must that criminal have thought upon hearing the words, "Truly, I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise"? I don't know about you, but when I read this in preparation, it gave me goosebumps. Do any of you? That's our third picture, Jesus on the cross and the thief being redeemed. So to draw the conclusion from these scenes, what do you think Pilate felt as he watched Jesus walk away, as he wiped his hands and dried his hands? Do you think he was happy that he had rid himself of an embarrassing situation? Do you think he was happy that he had mollified the citizens of Jerusalem? Did he view Good Friday as his victory? What did Barabbas think? I bet he was rubbing his eyes for the rest of the day. I bet he couldn't believe his luck. He was an insurrectionist. He was a murderer. He knew he was guilty. But here he was, free. He was only physically free. He did not understand. We might view Jesus' crucifixion as a huge injustice. We might view it as the greatest defeat, but it was not the greatest defeat. It was the greatest victory. In Isaiah 53, verses 10 and 11, which are going to be on the screen, Isaiah says, "Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for sin, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities." It was God's will that Jesus suffer on Good Friday. It was God's will that Jesus die on Good Friday. And it was God himself in the form of the Son who stepped down from heaven, who died as a great substitution for all of us. Through this substitution, the great reversal was complete. In the Old Testament and at the time of Jesus, at Passover, each family were to bring their lambs to the priests at the temple. And they were there, they were to be examined. And if without defect, they were to declare it a fitting sacrifice. Do you think the priests in the temple knew that when they had been interrogating Jesus and examining him, they had really been examining him as the sacrifice for all humanity? Do you think Pilate knew of the role he played in that ceremony when he declared Jesus not guilty? He declared him an acceptable sacrifice. Jesus is our perfect sacrifice. God, in a way much better than my parents did, gives us the choice between justice and mercy. Jesus has taken the justice that we deserved, and in return, we have received mercy. Let us pray. Father, I thank you for the words you spoke through Luke. I thank you for your sacrifice on the cross, that you died the death that was meant for us. I thank you for your love, that this was your plan, this was your substitution, and that because of your death, we can go free. Amen.
Thank you for listening to Words of Welcome. For new episodes and more, please visit welcomebaptistchurch.uk.